Hi, I'm Dana Stevens. I'm Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with the Slate spoiler special podcast on The Golden Compass. And joining me is Dan Coyce of New York Magazine's Culture Vulture blog. Dan, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thanks.
Dan, I have to say for this one, as tends to happen with the comic book movies we see together, I deliver myself utterly unto your hands because you are so much a creature of The Golden Compass book series that you named your firstborn after the heroine of the first book.
That's true.
And we saw the movie together the other night, and I confess that the diner conversation that we had afterward about the movie was far more entertaining and enlightening than anything that happened during the movie itself. So I want you to start off with a quick plot summary of The Golden Compass.
The Golden Compass is the first of a potential trilogy of movies based on Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. It's directed by Chris Weitz, and it is set in a Europe in a world that is like ours, but slightly different. In this world, humans have soul animals that travel along with them at all times called demons, which are reflections of their sort of innermost person. The story follows a young girl named Lyra as she finds out that her parentage is not what she thought it was and embarks on a great adventure in search of, well, in the movie, who knows what.
Yeah, so this is where things start to go a bit awry for me. As far as the setup of the world of The Golden Compass, which I knew a little bit about because of the tremendously popular books that people are always telling me to read, which I have not read. Now, having seen the movie, I really wish I'd read The Golden Compass because I couldn't make head or tail of it. But even though there's this initial concept of this world where your soul is kind of external and follows you around like an animal is really cool, I have to say that after about the first 10 minutes, this movie completely lost me story-wise. And I'm wondering what you think. Are these books impossible to make into a good movie? I mean, what went wrong here? First of all, you agree that it's a muddled mess, no?
I do agree that it's a muddled mess. This may be one of the rare examples of a terrible book adaptation that is still more pleasurable for fans of the book, if only because we were able to even have the slightest idea what was going on.
I wonder about that. I wonder if there's going to be a big division between fans of the book, like, well, there's non-readers of the book like me, but among fans of the book, I feel like there's maybe going to be the camp that say, well, at least I can follow the story and lord it over these poor fools who don't get it, like Dana. But then aren't there going to be a lot of people who feel really betrayed that their beloved Philip Pullman series is being made into a bunch of crappy movies?
Sure. And I
presumably
mean,
a bunch if two more do get made.
Well, or maybe not if this is not very well received. And it's entirely possible. I mean, in many ways, I do feel upset by the movie. I feel particularly upset with the fact that Lyra, the character, has been watered down so into sort of a boring young girl, given that I named my daughter after that person.
Right, you don't want her to turn out like the Lyra in this movie, who's
right,
a little
right.
bit of a typical Pris from sort of a orphaned English girl
right.
movie.
Well, I mean, I don't think at all that this was necessarily an impossible task. I think that it is potentially an impossible task to make at 2 hours when the things that are clearly the most important to the producers are the action sequences and set pieces. Throughout the process of making this movie, it's gone through a number of different script revisions and a couple of different screenwriters. Tom Stoppard did a draft at one point. Chris Weitz, who ended up writing this version, originally wrote a much longer version of the screenplay. That's the version that convinced the producers to give him the job in the first place.
And you've read that version, right?
Which I have read.
And you thought it was far superior and would have been a better movie?
I think so, but it's possible that I think so only because it almost literally is the book page by page.
And it would have been a long, long movie.
It was about 150 pages long, the screenplay, and it would have been at least 3 hours long in film form.
Well, so for readers of the book, can you talk a little bit about things that fell by the wayside, which maybe didn't in this original draft, but they certainly did between the book and the movie, and
sure.
what's missed the most?
A great deal of the material in Lyra's relationship with the woman who turns out to be her mother, Mrs. Coulter,
played by Nicole Kidman.
Played by Nicole Kidman is in the book and the original screenplay, but disappears from the movie. There's long sequences of her becoming gradually more and more disconcerted with her mother as she travels with her around London. There are long stretches giving us much better ideas of the world of the Egyptians, the characters who take Lyra under her wing. There are long sequences giving us much better ideas of the characters of the Ice Bears, the much hyped characters, one of whom Lyra befriends, these great, enormous armored bears who have their own society in the frozen wastes of the north. There's a much longer sequence of Lyra trapped in the experimental station, up north where horrible experiments are being done. And lastly, and most dramatically, as we talked about after the movie, the book ends with a number of plot beats beyond where the movie ends. The movie cuts off per maybe six or seven chapters before the end of the book. And earlier screenplays, earlier drafts of the screenplay of this movie continued the story to the tragic and extremely shocking ending of the book, which is nowhere present in the movie at all.
Right. Well, I guess part of the question will be, if another movie does get made, do those tragic and shocking things, which we can talk about, even happen in the next movie, or has Hollywood essentially softened this story so much that all the sharp edges and dark corners have been lopped off?
According to Chris Weitz, and what we're talking about here, for those who know the book and for those who don't but just want it spoiled, at the end of the book, Lyra has saved her close friend from her childhood, Roger, from a perilous fate. Thinking that she has saved him, she delivers him to her father, Lord Asriel, but unbeknownst to her, his intention is to kill that boy. And at the end of the book, he does. He kills that boy for his own purposes, which are to open up doors to another world. Lyra feels betrayed by her father and feels as though she has once again betrayed her friend and in fact is responsible for his death. The movie ends with Lyra and Roger happily sitting next to each other talking about the great adventures that lie before them.
One of the most craven beggings for a sequel that I've ever seen at the end of the movie, by the way. It essentially amounts to some kind of footnote, like, come give us $10 in a year.
It is a last scene of a movie that feels as though it was transcribed directly from, like, the marketing pitch delivered by the marketing people at New Line about how we can turn this into a sequel.
Yeah, it feels very tacked on, and it made me, out of just pure pettiness, want there never to be a sequel made so that it would just always sort of lie out there in space forever, that ending.
Right, like, you know, like the ill-fated ending of Hudson Hawk, where they look excitedly out into the great unknown at the further adventures that might face Hudson Hawk. According to Chris Weitz in interviews that he's done, his intention is to include the material from the end of book one at the beginning of movie two. He says he's going to, from a pure plot standpoint, it seems impossible to imagine that he wouldn't, because I simply couldn't understand how the plot could continue forward without that sacrifice being made. Because Roger has to die, because half of book three is Lyra visiting him in the land of the dead. And the window to other worlds has to open, because all of books two and three occur in other worlds. So,
well, we'll just see whether they can get around the plot point of Daniel Craig's character, Lord Asriel, killing a child, right? When he's basically been set up as the good parent against Nicole Kidman's bad parent. And by the way, the very fact they're parents is a huge spoiler, right? She doesn't find that out until
That is a huge spoiler, yes. She does not find that out until later. They are her parents, and she believes she's an orphan. Well, that's one thing I would like to talk about, because that, in the end, I think was the thing that infuriated me the most about the movie. There were things about the movie that I didn't mind at all as a fan of the books. I didn't mind how gorgeous the movie looked, and for anyone who really loves the books, they will certainly love the visualization of all the things they've imagined in their heads.
So it brought your interior world of the book to life?
It did, in a way that very few movies ever had, and that was fantastically
done. That's saying a lot.
It's saying a lot, and I'm glad that $180 million went somewhere. But the thing that frustrated me most about the movie, and that I think will frustrate many, was the watering down and the making more palatable of many of the characters of the movie, Lord Asriel being the most glaring example. In the movie, he is a cold and brutal and difficult man. He never shows a moment of warmth towards Lyra, even though she's his daughter. Even when she tracks him down in the original version of the book and in the original version of the screenplay in the frozen north to rescue him, he simply looks horrified that she's arrived and asks her what the hell she thinks she's doing. He describes his own daughter as an ignorant savage. And in the movie, Daniel Craig, either through direction or through his own choice, plays him as sort of a grumpy but generally warm guy. And the first shot we see of him is him smiling as he thinks of Lyra, which in and of itself is one more smile than he delivers in the entire trilogy of books.
Right.
As a character, he's imposing and impressive, and he is exactly the kind of character who you could imagine doing the amazing and impossible things that Asriel does in the books. In the movie, he is simply an adventurer. I mean, almost, you know,
a kindly rogue.
A kindly rogue, an Indiana Jones type who's a little grumpy but has a heart of gold.
Well, it may be, and we should probably wrap up on this, but it may be that, you know, the softening of his character is sort of goes hand in hand with the softening of the book's anti-clericalism, which I don't know that much about, but just read this great long piece by Hannah Rosen in the Atlantic Monthly about, I mean, obviously the anti-Catholic position of the books, which are somewhat of a screed against the Catholic Church, as I understand, right? It's been softened. But then by the same token, Daniel Craig, Lord Asriel, who represents, I guess, science, right? The sort of Faustian scientist who's the opposite of the church, somebody who's trying to find out about pure knowledge of other universes for knowledge's sake, also in the book comes off as someone brutal and ruthless. So it's philosophically a lot more complex than anything the movie has time to even give a second to.
Right. I mean, a lot has been made of the movie's softening of the anti-religious message of the books. But the movie also, by that token, by softening Lord Asriel so much, also really kind of softens the anti-science and anti-reason aspect.
The whole debate
is
just blunted on both sides.
Yeah, there's really no debate at all. It ends up being a very soft discussion of free will and the importance of doing what's right and blah, 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 blah.
Following your dream, having courage, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, to tell you the truth, if I didn't sort of know from, you know, previous and post-movie interesting conversations about the books that there was this sort of great cosmological debate happening throughout the books, the movie would just basically be about a little girl running around with a scary bear king. I mean, I was very unable to follow much beyond here's the good guys, here's the bad guys, and who's going to get the little gold compass, which essentially functions as sort of like the ultimate BlackBerry of the future, right?
Right.
It has all
right.
information from the beginning of time if you just know how to consult it correctly.
Right, if you put your mind in the right place. Yeah, so to sum up, I would say
it's unrecommended.
I mean, it is gorgeous to look at, one of the prettier movies to look at I've seen in a long time.
But what about two heartbroken fans of the book? Would you say stay away completely?
I'd say set your expectations really low. Maybe put some earplugs in and go in and just watch.
And a blindfold?
And no, keep your eyes open, but put your earplugs in. Go in and watch. And then when you get home, imagine the movie that it could have been.
Oh, that's so sad. It's tragic.
Yes, my poor daughter will never know the glorious drama that could have
That's
been
That's right. Are you
going to
protect
life.
Lyra from the knowledge of what her movie became?
We'll let her read the books, but we'll never let her see the movie.
Until she's 18, the age of consent has passed, and she's off to the movies.
I mean, if she's willing to divorce us, to legally separate from us, sure, but otherwise, no.
Well, Dan, thanks a lot for coming in to discuss The Golden Compass.
My pleasure.
And for Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.